This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, Daimler Chrysler announced that it would sell 80% of its troubled Chrysler division to Cerberus Capital Management, a private equity firm that specializes in restructuring struggling companies. Daimler bought Chrysler for $36 billion 9 years ago. On paper, it gets $7.4 billion back, but analysts say that Daimler may have to spend that much to cover losses until the deal actually goes through. The sale is being hailed as a watershed moment for Chrysler and for the United Auto Workers Union, for all American car manufacturers, and for private equity firms, and the key factor for them all is how to manage health and retirement obligations for generations of auto workers. Later, we have an email challenge for you. What's your favorite Chrysler car, or what kind of a car would you like to see Chrysler build now? Email us, talk@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk with auto critic Dan Neal. But first, the Daimler-Chrysler split. If you have questions about the challenges that face Chrysler, Cerberus, the UAW, and Detroit, join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Robin Farzad, the Wall Street and Markets editor for Business Week magazine. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
And I know you've covered Cerberus extensively. What's in this for them?
Cerberus is one big enigma, I think, to even observers of the private equity community. It's a super exclusive, elusive private equity fund that was started with all of $10 million in 1992 and shift to 2007. They have $25 billion in capital. You can barely find a photo of its founder, much less a video. They're super exclusive. They have this kitchen cabinet of former cabinet officials,
right.
CEOs, this wonderful bullpen of executives. And I'm just racking my brain for the past 24 hours thinking what they're going to do with this deal. And it occurred to, I think, the financial journalism community about 24 hours ago that maybe this was a play to get Chrysler's financing arm, that these guys are really deft investors, that they noticed that the parent company, Daimler, just wanted to get rid of this disaster of a deal 9 years after the fact, and that they could salvage some sort of modicum of value of it.
Don't they already own GMAC?
They own a controlling stake in GMAC, a 51% stake, and that's just a wonderfully profitable business. You could take advantage of the low interest rate environment right now to extend auto loans, mortgages, all manner of credit to investors, and then repackage those loans and sell them to sophisticated institutional investors and just really get a license to mint money. And the fact is GM had to sell it under duress. So similarly here, I think that they're not quite vulture investors, but they did notice that Daimler was in distress and was really eager to close the door on this forgettable chapter that they acquired Chrysler 9 years ago.
On the other hand, what they have acquired includes many billions of dollars in obligations to health care and pension funds. What are they going to do about that?
Well, you could say that they are the third parties. They're the change agents, the mercenaries brought in. It's one thing for the United Auto Workers to deal with company executives and that vitriol and that historic debate between the two where they kind of face each other down. It's been covered so much in the press. But when you bring in a third party, essentially Cerberus, like its private equity ilk, has a license to be a mercenary, has a license to be opportunistic. So while they tried to oppose the deal, the United Auto Workers, they kind of quietly with resignation went into it. And I think they realized that Cerberus is going to take a huge saw to some of these expenses. And you really have no recourse now. If you want to shut it down, you don't have as much leverage as you did with the corporate parent that was a pure play automotive company. Cerberus has many more tricks up its sleeve.
So they could have the opportunity to a deal that a lot of people are talking about in the newspapers as they cover this morning is something called a VEBA. This was the kind of deal worked out with Goodyear and their union earlier this year, where basically the company offloaded the pension and health care program to the union, and VEBA stands for Voluntary Employee Benefits Association, and so that Cerberus could either say, look, UAW, you take the obligations of this pension program, we're going to give you X amount of money, or we'll go Chapter 11.
Right, and that's the UAW's best possible option right now. They saw it happen. It worked with Goodyear, which was almost left for dead a couple of years ago. The shares have tripled in the past year on enthusiasm that the company has more viability as a going concern. And that just might be the case here with Chrysler. The broader theme here, if you step back, is that these guys, the private equity superstars of this day and age, not just Cerberus, but you step back and look at Blackstone, Colbert Kravis Roberts, the Carlyle Group, which is this storied private equity firm out of D.C. that has so many cabinet ministers and former vice presidents on its board and all these luminaries, they have a way of looking at assets and finding value where the conventional investor can't find value. You saw what was done with Kmart a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The sophisticated investor Eddie Lampert came in and took a company that was on death's doorstep. It really had no way of competing with Target and Walmart and found some sort of residual real estate value and parlayed that into making the company's stock go up tenfold, acquiring Sears, which was similarly moribund. And now the whole thing is much less of a retailer than it is a play on real estate and intellectual property. They kind of morphed something that was so conventional and so moribund into something that actually has the market's interest once again. And we rack our brains in journalism and financial journalism to figure out how they do it. But I would not count these guys out. They were there since the very beginning. They showed interest in auto parts makers. As you said, they bought GMAC's controlling interest. Watch them parlay this into something that we never could have predicted.
Well, joining us now is John McElroy, editorial director for Blue Sky Productions, host of the television programs Autoline Detroit and American Driver on Detroit Public Television. He's with us today from the studios of our member station in Detroit, WDET. Nice to have you on the broadcast.
Thanks, Neil.
And let's talk about another phrase that we're flipping around today, and that is flip and strip, that the idea that what Cerberus may be doing is looking for those profitable bits of Chrysler to trim them down, sell them off, and dump the rest.
Well, that's been one of the approaches that some of the other equity firms have taken, but I don't think that's going to happen in this case. Look, Chrysler is pretty lean and stripped right now as it is. I don't see what you would take and break off. If you did, some people have talked about, well, they could sell Jeep because it's a world iconic brand and you could get a lot of money for it. But you do that and you take away any chance of profitability at Chrysler. Look, what Cerberus wants to do is they're buying distressed property right now. They're getting a bargain basement price for it. This company's not a basket case. Yes, it lost money in the first quarter. Yes, it lost money last year. But it made several billion dollars in profit for a number of years running before that. It shouldn't be that hard to get it back to making several billion again. And if you can do that, Cerberus, somewhere down the road, I'm saying probably two automotive design cycles, or about 7 years down the road or so, will be able to flip this, to use the parlance, or sell it for a whopping big profit. That's what they're in it for.
And the idea that, again, those obligations to the pension and health care programs, whatever deal Cerberus might be able to make with the United Auto Workers could set a precedent for the other big two automakers in Detroit?
Well, there's no question. Look, what has got Detroit's automakers just dragging right now are these legacy costs. They have pension costs and health care costs that were awarded 30, 40 years ago to workers, never realizing we're going to live as old as we do right now. Mm-hmm. GM's oldest retiree is 110 years old. He punched out his last time card in 1959. He's been retired longer than he ever worked for the company. And guess what? On a percentage basis, the greatest growing demographic amongst General Motors retirees or auto worker retirees right now are people over 100 years old. No one had any clue we were going to live this long and spend that much money keeping us alive that long.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. Our guests, you just heard John McElroy, editorial director for Blue Sky Productions and automotive expert. Also with us, Robin Farzad, Business Week's Wall Street and Markets editor. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Joe. Joe's with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
The one thing, I'm hearing a lot of financial analysts talk, but I'm not really hearing a lot of talk about improving the product. And what I'm concerned about is the influence of the oil industry on the big three. I noticed that I learned today just in the last few minutes that Carlyle Group is one of the holders of this equity fund, and I'm greatly concerned that they'll continue to propagate our highways with gas-guzzling, low-mileage vehicles so that the oil industry continues to make these massive profits. And what I think this is a golden opportunity, and I wish somebody in the financial industry would investigate the impact of the oil industry through equity funds in the big three and possibly changing this pattern so that we go back to what we did best, which is being the manufacturing kings of the world and the country that invented the auto industry.
Robin Farzad, does Joe have a point here?
I think the issues are inextricably linked. Look, if you look at the gold standard right now, Toyota Motors, they're no longer this stereotypical Japanese automaker the way you saw in that movie Gung Ho in the mid-80s. They're very much represented in the Midwest, in Kentucky, in Ohio, churning out the greenest fleet in the industry. You talk about the Prius. You talk about them bringing on a Camry hybrid. They are nipping at everybody else's heels and knocking out the big three. That takes years of planning and design and innovation, and that, in this case, is inextricably linked to their pension obligations. It's just suffocating when you have, you know, several hundreds of dollars up to $1,000, $1,500 in legacy costs per car. You can't be competitive, and you can't afford to take five or six risks thinking out three or four product cycles on a proprietary green technology. But I doubt that there's any sort of collusion here to kind of churn out gas guzzlers. We see that in the case of General Motors, the gas guzzlers are actually a profit center for them. But in Toyota's case, green could be much more profitable, and I think it's on that trajectory. And any strategic investor, any financial investor that takes on a company today has to be cognizant of the fact that things are rapidly moving green. And you can't just be oblivious to that, whether you hold this asset for 2 or 3 years or 5 or 7 years.
And
can I follow up with that, please?
We're just about out of time, so if you make it very, very quick.
I just bought a Camry hybrid. It's an incredible vehicle. Hybrid technology is not a risk. Who could call it a risk?
Yeah, but it involves money. This is not something that Toyota did overnight. It did it through many iterations, and it was first a drain on profit.
All right, Joe, thanks very much for the call. We'll get back to more calls when we come back. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. We're talking about Chrysler's sale to a private equity firm and if this is the best way to save a car company. If you have questions about the deal or what it means, again, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or zap us an email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Chrysler's sale to a private investment firm could mean big changes for the big three car makers in Detroit, and the buyer hopes make them some money. You can read more about the impact of the sale at npr.org. Our guests are Robin Farzad, the Business Week's Wall Street and Markets editor, and John McElroy, an automotive expert, host of Autoline Detroit and American Driver on Detroit Public Television. If you have questions about the challenges faced by Chrysler, Cerberus, the private equity firm that's buying it, the UAW, and Detroit in general, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation, and we have a car-related email challenge for you today. Is there a car Chrysler makes that you really love? And what kind of car do you think Chrysler should make now? Send that email to us, talk@npr.org. We'll read some of your suggestions when Dan Neal, the car critic for the Los Angeles Times, joins us a little bit later on. But John McElroy, I wanted to get back to the question that we had on the air just before the break. If Chrysler makes a line of gas guzzlers, that's not going to help them, is it?
Well, it's not, except that it's very ironic when you look at April sales, which are the latest numbers that we have. The biggest SUVs saw great growth. I don't mean up a little bit. They were up by double digits. And the reason any automaker, and it should be pointed out, too, that Toyota's greatest growth in the American market in the last 5 years has all come from introducing SUVs and big. In fact, they've got one of the biggest pickup trucks out there right now in the new Tundra. People buy these things. You know, you can blame the auto industry for building gas guzzlers, and believe me, the Japanese are just as guilty in that as the American ones are. But they build them because people buy them. Until you change buyer behavior, the auto industry is just not going to change that much.
Even at $3 a gallon. All right, let's get
to... Well, look, $3 a gallon is nothing. In Europe, it's $7 a gallon in many countries. In Japan, it's $5. And yet people buy new cars all the time.
Matt's with us on the line from Syracuse, New York.
Hi. Listen, I work at one of the auto plants up here at New Process Gear in Syracuse, and we build transmissions for Chrysler. And over the past 10 years or so, we've kind of watched the management just go from bad to worse. And another thing I just want to touch on is people are always, they always complain about how much automakers make, But if you look in the parking lot of our factory, you'll see that we almost everybody buys what we make. And if people aren't allowed to be paid a living wage, you know, who is going to buy these cars when you've got a truck that costs $40,000? And I want to know what your guest thinks about if Cerberus is going to be able to kind of put some more intelligence into the management and see if they can market our things better so that more people will buy them.
All right. Well, let's first, John McElroy, is Matt right, mismanagement at Chrysler the last 10 years?
Well,
or so?
You know, we need to get a little bit more background on that. But naturally, any auto worker and any worker anywhere does not like to see benefits cut. They don't like to see wages cut. They don't like to see people hired in at much lower wages. So there could be a lot of dissatisfaction with that, but I'm afraid to say that when Cerberus takes over, you're only going to see more of that trend continue, because there's no question about it. The Detroit 3 with UAW labor costs are operating at much higher costs than their competition, not in Japan, not in Mexico, not in Korea, but right here in the United States.
Tennessee,
Toyota,
yeah.
Honda, Nissan et al. Are building cars here. In fact, Toyota makes most of its profits in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And
but they don't have to pay. They're not on the same playing field that we are.
No, exactly what he's saying. He's saying they don't have the same legacy costs, the pension plans and the health care plan. Robin Farzad, is Cerberus likely to make... What kind of changes do you think Cerberus is likely to make?
I can assure you that they're going to make changes that serve their self-interest, which, you know, I don't want to sound like Gordon Gekko here, but it's a free market. It's a brutal market. The globalized world right now, however cliche it sounds, however much you want to invoke Thomas Friedman, it's the reality of the moment. You can walk into a Walmart and without guilt buy a $17 DVD player. Why aren't the electronics manufacturers in the West Coast from 30 years ago complaining about it? This seems to be the manifest destiny of manufacturing jobs to be headed overseas. And to the extent that you do want to succeed in the United States, you have to be nimble, you have to be lean, you have to be shorn of legacy costs, and Toyota came in with a clean slate. I just don't know if these types of cultural pillars can be introduced within the 4, 5, 6, 7 year holding period that I think Cerberus has in mind for this asset. And I hate to call it an asset, but I'm looking at it from their perspective. They're financial investors. They are not strategic investors. They're not looking for a happy Lee Iacocca story from the early 80s necessarily. They're looking to turn a buck. And that's just the reality of the matter.
Well, yesterday, thanks for the call, Matt. John Snow, the former Treasury Secretary, is now the chairman of the Cerberus Group, was talking about one of our benefits. We're a private company. We can look out for the long term, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, without having to worry about that quarterly return that stockholders are going to be so concerned about.
I mean, of course they can say that, but it cuts both ways. If you're a public company, I believe my take on this is that the auto workers have a lot of leverage if they can shut it down, the stock price. You know, they go on a strike. The stock price tanks. Management kind of has to come to its knees and give the auto workers what they want, essentially punting the ball on another set of negotiations 4 or 5 years out. Private equity investors like to say that they're long-term focused. Right now, it's really in vogue to say that the public capital markets, the stock market, puts way too much in the way of pressure on companies in the post-Sarbanes-Oxley period with all this transparency. You have to think quarter after quarter. It's a wonderful talking point, but you cannot underestimate how mercenary this company is going to be about it, even if they bring out the former Treasury Secretary. Of course he's going to say that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see if we can get Matt on the line. Matt with us from Des Moines.
Hey, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was a salesperson for both Chrysler and Toyota on a dealership, and I got a pretty unique perspective of both companies. And as far as Chrysler goes, that was my number one objection overcome every single time I had somebody in front of me was the quality of the vehicle compared to a Toyota or a Honda, even coming up now, the other smaller Asian vehicles. I think they have an opportunity. If they are going to continue with Chrysler and continue to make cars, they have an opportunity to do something different. They can do like your previous callers had said, put a little more quality into the vehicle. If not, look at a different line. You're talking about alternative fuels or even hybrid technology. That technology is out there. They don't have to reinvent the wheel. They can just go forward and make something a little bit better.
Yeah, but John McElroy, as you pointed out, this takes time. And it also takes a certain degree of, I don't think morale is going to be too great at Chrysler factories for the next little bit anyway.
Well, you know, everybody's, Sorry. I think everybody in the factory, of course, or anybody in the company right now, is a little bit uneasy about what the future holds. But I think that will also settle down very quickly. And what they'll find is that, you know, it almost doesn't matter who owns the company in terms of what you've got to do to get your job done day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you look at what's going on in the market right now, Chrysler's not doing very badly. They've come out with a lot of new product in the last year. They've got a lot coming out this year and in the next 2 years. In fact, their sales were up strong in the last month. They're up strong for the year. They've gained a point of market share, which in this market is quite an accomplishment.
Matt? When I'm told as a salesperson with a straight face my first week on the job, look at the invoice on the inside of the door, and no offense to the people who call in that work for Chrysler, but if a car is made on a Monday or a Friday, don't sell it. And I'm telling you, this is what came out of their mouth. Monday they were hungover, Friday they wanted to go home. So the quality.
You know, that's a slam on all the auto workers. And listen, I've worked in the factories myself. I don't buy that for a second. Yeah, maybe way back when, but I don't buy that for a second these days. Okay. These people are highly motivated. They know what the competition is. They know Toyota, Honda et al. Are breathing down their necks. I just don't see those kinds of problems anymore. And if you go to the J.D. Power data, for example, it backs that up. The highest-ranked automotive plant in North America, ahead of Toyota, in fact, is a General Motors plant in Oshawa, Canada. So you can absolutely build very high-quality vehicles with union labor, and there's just a lot of perception that's dragged on from decades past.
Matt, for how long is the quality there? If I'm showed statistics to say that I have a Lexus or a Toyota or a Honda that outperforms these vehicles year after year, if my vehicle is going to be new for 36 months compared to something that's going to be new for 12 months, which car do you think I'm going to buy? And where are these people's incentives to work harder if they're sitting in limbo thinking, is Chrysler going to be picked apart like you guys are talking about?
Well, Matt, Lexus, I think we're talking about a different price range. But anyway, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to Lee, and Lee's with us from Trenton, New Jersey.
Yes, hello, everybody.
Hello.
Boy, to be a corporate analyst. I mean, that appears to be the new steady stable jobs these days. Anyhow, look, what I'm calling about is nobody appears to be standing for the workers here, and I'm really concerned that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, these people are really going to get the short end of this deal. And I'm a truck driver, and, you know, and I deliver loads in a Chrysler, and you know, I mean, Chrysler going under would be very bad for my business, but even worse for my business would be see another deterioration in the middle class.
Mm-hmm. Robin Farzad, as I understand it, Chrysler is already in the process of shedding something like 14,000, 15,000 jobs in a workforce that's going to be about 80,000. Is that
it's
right?
It's an ongoing process, and it's really a war, a battle of attrition, and it's been going on for the better part of 25 years. To confess, I'm sorry?
Let me just say one other thing. You know, my advice to the Chrysler workers is, in this situation, really stand up for yourselves, because if you don't, nobody else will.
We'll get to that in just a minute, Lee, but let Robin finish his point.
Look, let me throw something out. On a personal level, I was really moved by a movie I saw in the late 80s, Michael Moore's documentary, Roger and Me. It actually motivated me way back when to pursue a career in financial journalism. I wanted, you know, I felt the indignation of people kind of being lopped off 20,000 at a time at GM on a Christmas. But when you dig deeper on these things, and no one wants to sound mercenary about it, no one's job in this country is guaranteed anymore. Jobs are moving in this osmosis across borders. GM makes cars in Canada, manufactures parts in China, things are made in Mexico. It's just so much harder in this day and age. And again, I don't want to sound platitudinous or mercenary or whatever you want to call it, to say that you are entitled to a job. It is a matter of innovating or falling by the wayside. And until workers recognize that, until management recognizes that it can't just punt the ball on these really tough issues, the company's just not going to have any sort of upside. And there won't be any jobs to protect in 15 years. I just think that's the way it is.
John McElroy, as to who looks out for the workers, most of Chrysler's workers are represented by the United Auto Workers. The contracts for all three big car companies come up this summer.
Let me
do.
Go ahead, John.
And I think we're really... we've got a great chance of a strike happening this fall. In fact, I think this fall's negotiations are going to be the most important since the union first formed, because we've got to deal with this legacy cost issue. As I said earlier, Toyota, Honda, Nissan, Hyundai, Kia, BMW, Mercedes-Benz. There's others out there. I can't even think of them all off the top of my head. Love building cars and trucks in the United States. They think this is a great place to manufacture. As I said before, Toyota, Honda, Nissan, they make most of their profit here. But they don't have these legacy costs of these gigantic pension obligations, retiree health care, and even health care of the normal workers. If you get down to the wages, what the workers see in their paychecks, Toyota now has to pay as much as any UAW worker gets just to try and keep the UAW out of its plants. The same holds true for Honda and Nissan as well. So the U.S. is a great place to manufacture. But the big three, the Detroit three, I guess I should say, really have got to get their costs in line with other manufacturers in this country, because if they cannot invest in the kind of new product that they've got to, they can't get into the new technology that they need to, it's just going to be the steady downward spiral that we've seen, that they lose market share and have to close plants and lay off workers. So this fall's negotiations, and I think Cerberus is going to play a critical role in how that gets determined, what the outcome will come, that is. We're headed for a showdown, I believe, this fall.
We're talking with John McElroy, the editorial director for Blue Sky Productions, the host of the television programs Autoline Detroit and American Driver. Also with us is Robin Farzad. He's the Business Week's Wall Street and Markets editor. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get another caller in. Nick. Nick's with us from Indiana.
Hey, guys. Love your show.
Thank you.
Here's my question. I've seen a rumor back when Daimler bought Chrysler, that reading an article in which they said that one of the reasons might have been because Daimler was looking at Chrysler having billions of dollars in the bank to cover health care costs and retirement benefits. And there was some suspicion they might take those funds and use them for other things. I'm just wondering if that ever happened. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, Nick. Can you help him out, John McElroy?
Yeah, absolutely. He's absolutely right. I can't remember the exact figure, but there were some $10 billion or thereabouts lying around, and kavoom, that money just disappeared as soon as Daimler got its mitts on Chrysler. So where that money went, it probably went into their general accounts fund, and who knows what it was spent on.
And in terms of return, I wonder, one of the things that Daimler said going into this deal is, you know, we're going to bring all this wonderful German technology to Chrysler and improve their product line. Did Chrysler get benefits on that side of it?
Well, look, you know, this was always portrayed as a merger of equals. It was nothing of the sort. It was a takeover. If it had been a true merger of equals and they had looked to Chrysler and said, hey, look, you guys are really good at product development. Man, are you fast. And your plants are way more efficient than what we have at Mercedes. And if you look at the Mercedes side and say, oh, my goodness, look at this technology, especially the advanced technology, and look at the dynamics that you guys have been able to develop and the quality that you've got. And if you had shoved those two things together, I think you would have seen a hybrid company come out of it. But in point in fact, they only treated Chrysler as sort of this second stepchild. There was some cooperation between them. There was some technology and component sharing, and that part of it worked wonderfully well, but they were never able to get the synergy because I think it was a flawed concept from the get-go. It was not a merger of equals. It was a takeover.
One last call. Mike. Mike is with us from St. Louis.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, Mike. Go ahead.
My parents are retired Chrysler from here in the St. Louis area. And the panic button was pushed the other night as far as their benefits and their pension plans and whatnot. And I was wondering if you could touch a little bit about that. I was just listening to the negotiations going on this summer. Are they cutting benefits right off the bat, or is that something that has to wait for contract negotiations? And what do you see happening with this new owners? And I'm going to hang up and listen. Okay?
Okay, Mike, thanks very much. I guess John McElroy, that's to you.
Well, you know, it's going to be tough. Look, anybody who's got a pension, they're going to have their pension. It's always going to be there. There is a legal obligation to be able to meet that. But when you look at some of the other things that were negotiated years ago, retiree health care, I think it's very likely that all the car companies are going to say, hey, look, if you qualify for Medicaid, boom, we're not paying any of your medical expenses as a retiree. In addition to that, I believe that they're going to ask their hourly workers to have a higher level of copay than what they do right now for their health insurance. Because UAW workers, man, I sure would love to have their health care benefits, because I don't know anybody who has it as well as they do right now.
I guess we're going to have to leave it there. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Robin Farzad, the Business Week's Wall Street and Markets editor, joined us today from our bureau in New York. John McElroy, editorial director for Blue Sky Productions and host of the television programs Autoline Detroit and American Driver that are on Detroit Public Television. He joins us today from our member station in Detroit, WDET. This is more than just a business story about unions and profits. Chrysler needs people to want and buy its cars. When we come back, car critic Dan Neal will join us to talk about what's ahead in their showrooms. What's your favorite Chrysler car, and what car do you want Chrysler to offer? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.